Hello, welcome back to the show. This is Coast to Coast AM, sitting in for George Norrie. I'm Dave Schrader. Help me out this year with the Polar Plunge for Special Olympics, along with my son, who is a veteran and a Minnesota firefighter. We are helping to raise money and awareness for the Special Olympics. We do this thing every year called the Polar Plunge in Minnesota. They'll cut big holes in the ice, and we will all jump in hand into frigid cold water, kind of like the ice bucket challenge a few years ago, magnified by 1,000. And we do this to help raise awareness and, more importantly, raise much-needed funds to help the Special Olympians around the world that need a little boost in their training, their travel, and being able to participate in the Special Olympics. You can donate any amount. Just email me, dave@darknessradio.com, dave@darknessradio.com. I'll send you out a link. You can go in and donate anonymously or let us know who you are and how you heard about it. We'd love for you to help us hit our $3,000 goal. Last year, with the help of the Coast to Coast audience, we were able to not only hit it, but we surpassed that $3,000 goal, almost hit $5,000. And that goes a long way to help out these great athletes so that they can participate in these games. Just email me, dave@darknessradio.com. We'll get you in and you can be a part of that and help us out. On July 1st through the 3rd of 1863, two mighty armies clash outside the small town of Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. In the aftermath, tens of thousands lay dead or wounded. Many of those poor souls left abandoned on the battlefield for weeks or days. The Battle of Fairfield, the Fairfield haunting on the Gettysburg Ghost Trail. Richard Estep, our guest, when we return to Coast AM. We're back, and tonight we'll be joined for the remainder of the show by Richard Estep. He's a paramedic, a volunteer firefighter, and he hails from Great Britain, currently making his home here in the United States. When he's not traveling the world collecting ghost stories and investigating haunted house, he writes about these very same places, having fun investigating the claims of the paranormal, putting himself into the footsteps of history. And that's what we're here to talk about tonight, his newest book, which is out and available, and fascinating stuff, The Fairfield Haunting on the Gettysburg Ghost Trail. Richard, thank you for joining us.
Dave, it's always a pleasure.
Yeah, it's great to chat with you, and I had the great privilege of being able to write the foreword for your Asylum Haunting of Asylum 49 book. I love when you come out with these new books because you really do get deep into the research and understanding of these locations. What drew your attention to focus for this book this time?
Well, Dave, I've always been a Civil War buff. The reason I went, though, was that I did a convention, a Paracon, in Houston, Texas, last summer. And it was the week after the hurricane had just hit Houston. So the con wasn't well attended, unfortunately. And I found myself sitting next to Brad and Barry Kling from Ghost Lab, the guys from Everyday Paranormal. And we got to talking, because things were kind of slow, about some of our favorite cases. And Brad happens to be a Civil War buff, too. So we were chatting back and forth, and he said one of his favorite locations was this old former Confederate hospital right outside Gettysburg, about 8 miles southwest of the town. And that he and his brother and their crew had investigated there for the TV show and had found the place to be very, very active. And the more he told me, I went back and looked at the show, looked at some of the evidence that they had caught, and I thought, I have just got to go there and see for myself.
The place is unbelievable. It's one of those kind of places that you really have to go to and steep yourself into the environment and the history of it as well, because it's a part of our history. It's a dark part of our history, a sad and brutal part of our history. But if you were to believe that a scarring could really take place in time and space, that would be a location for such a scarring.
Absolutely, Dave. And all wars tragic, of course, we all know that, but civil wars are doubly so because you have father and son squaring off, you have brothers on separate sides of the divide, and this is a three-day weekend, really, where you had as many American casualties as you had during the Vietnam conflict, because you have family fighting family across the divide. So that, I think, makes it doubly tragic and makes the emotion much more heightened than in a normal war, if there is such a thing.
I agree with you, especially that kind of that kind of war and just how, you know, it was our own country, our own land. Here we had broken away from England, no offense, Richard, but we'd come over here to start new and get away from the tyranny that we felt we were under. And we couldn't even get along over here. We couldn't get along on simple thoughts like the idea that everyone should be created equal and treated equally. And there was this great divide that took place. And when these battles would occur, they were vicious and they were relentless, and they left blood and death in their wake in a totally new way here in our young little country.
Well, it was a carnage that was just horrific and unparalleled, wasn't it? You have tens of thousands of men dying on such a scale, and not dying immediately, many of them. Reading the accounts of the time, you have these poor boys that were wounded, brutally wounded, and would lay there overnight because their comrades couldn't recover them, just didn't have the ability or the manpower to do it. And they would be thirsty, they would be bleeding, they would be in great, great pain. And one of the things that struck me as so very horrific was that there are accounts of the generals having bands play at night in an attempt to drown out the screams of the wounded so that, you know, the soldiers could get some sleep at least. I mean, it's just inconceivable to us today.
Oh, that is horrific. Well, this specific spot, I mean, there's so much and so many places throughout Gettysburg and around the United States where the Civil War played out. Why do you think that the Gettysburg area is so active with claims of the paranormal?
That's a really good question, because there are numerous accounts of haunted Civil War battlefields around the U.S., but Gettysburg, pound for pound, seems to have more accounts than anywhere else. And I think some of it might be the sheer scale and the sheer ferocity of the fighting. This was the high watermark of the Confederacy. Before this battle, the South still had a chance to win. They'd been handing the Union Army, they'd been defeating them on a fairly regular basis up until this summer of 1863. Even though they had fewer men, you could argue that they outgeneraled the Union Army on a fairly regular basis. But they just lost one of their key generals. Stonewall Jackson had been shot by his own men after the Battle of Chancellorsville, and Grant had not yet taken over against Robert E. Lee. So there was about to be this big shifting. But Robert E. Lee did not have this supply of men and materiel to replace his losses that the Union side under George McClellan did. So this was really Lee's biggest push to break the back of the Union Army. And if he could do that, he could position himself close to Washington, threaten the capital, and hopefully force a ceasefire and come to the negotiation table. So after Gettysburg, the South never really had a chance to win the war.
The idea, too, that we have so much bloodshed in an area. Richard, I had an interview with a gentleman named Paul Dosti, who is a cadaver dog specialist. And we were just talking about the science of cadaver dogs and how when somebody bleeds and or is decomposing, how they leave this genetic time stamp, if you will, that dogs can locate hundreds of years afterwards in an outdoor environment. And that's pretty remarkable to me. I mean, to think that a dog could walk out into a field, find a spot where somebody had been murdered maybe 50, 60 years ago, and within 10 yards or, you know, of that spot, you dig up a body. That means that there is some kind of energetic pattern left behind, right? There is some kind of measurable energy that a dog is able to trace and track, which began to resonate with me with the idea of when you have such a place like Gettysburg, which is rich with death and carnage, the idea of a haunting doesn't seem so far removed now from science, right? Because science tells us that there are still molecules, there are scents, there are bacteria, and that's after frost, rain, heat, and there's still something that remains that is traceable. Then maybe part of our humanity is traceable too. Part of our spirit or our essence is still left behind in those spots.
I think you might be onto something there, Dave, entirely.
I'm either onto something or I'm on something. It's one of those two.
No, I think you are onto something. I don't know about the latter. I'll leave you to speak to that. But I definitely think you could be onto something there. And certainly the sheer volume year after year of accounts, not just from Gettysburg itself, but from the surrounding townships, something definable is going on there that is, for want of a better term, out of this world. And something else I think that may be playing into this is, if you go to Gettysburg, and I encourage everybody to go at least once, it's relatively unspoiled. The battlefield itself, it takes very little imagination to see how things must have looked during those days. Although there are monuments and markers everywhere, pretty much the only thing that spoiled the battlefield is a McDonald's, unfortunately, which is sitting just off the end. But for the most part, it takes no effort on the part of somebody to stand there and see what this must have looked like during that 3-day period, you know? So it's relatively the same. The topography, the terrain, all that kind of stuff looks very similar now as it did back then. And I think that may play a role as well. We know the concept of era cues, where you might, say, dress in a reenactor's uniform. I met a number of reenactors while I was out there. They just wander around the town going about their business. And there was a wedding on. So there's a big wedding, and of course everybody was dressed in blue and gray uniforms for this wedding. And to be honest with you, my first instinct was to want to go up and just gently poke everybody to make sure that they were real. Gettysburg still lives and breathes what happened on that period of time for 3 days during 1863. I don't want to say it's caught in the time warp or anything like that, but I think that plays a role, Dave. It really must.
No, I agree with you. There is something special about these locations. You know, like Jeff Belanger, the author and researcher, has said that ghosts are history's way of reminding us where we've been. And especially in the case of war, it's important that we remember, so hopefully we don't continue to make the same mistakes.
Yeah, as a species, our track record in that regard isn't great, is it? But Gettysburg is a living testament to what happened. And going to the battlefield itself, I made a point of going at sunrise as soon as the park opened. So you can go at sunrise and just sit there with nobody else around and very little traffic on the roads. And I went to Little Round Top, which was the scene of some of the fiercest fighting. And those who've seen the movie Gettysburg will probably remember this as the scene where Jeff Daniels' 20th Maine Regiment runs out of ammunition and does this bayonet charge in order to prevent the Union line being flanked. And there is something deeply spiritual about that place, especially as the sun is either just coming up or just going down. And it truly is haunted, literally or not, take it as you will, but the atmosphere there is 100% spiritual. There is a sense that something momentous took place. It's woven into the very fabric of the rocks and the grass and the ground itself. I'm not a sensitive guy, Dave, in terms of psychic sensitivity, but even I could feel it, that this is a place of great import.
When you went and stepped on these hallowed grounds and you could sense that power, that being that transcends just the moment that we're in, but that it goes so far into the past and so far into the future, were you able to pick up on any of the actual paranormal aspect of this? And how do you divide the line between actually experiencing the paranormal or just experiencing what your consciousness perceives should happen there?
Well, the ability to record something is key. And I make a point of having a voice recorder with me on these kind of trips running continuously. I've been burned over the past 23 years too many times of not having a recorder running, and something happens and I scrabble to get set up and, you know, you've missed the boat, as it were. So I had a recorder running continuously. And a couple of instances, one was on Little Round Top with nobody around. We recorded the sound of voices indistinctly talking. Couldn't make out what they were saying, but definitely not the wind. It was a completely windless day. You know, things were very still and calm. But the one that caught me the most was at Pickett's Charge, which, for those who aren't familiar with the campaign, this was on the afternoon of the third day when Pickett's men, the Confederates, were launching this last-ditch attack on the center of the Union line. On the first day, they hit one of the flanks. On the second day, they hit the other flank hard, and General Lee knew he had one good punch left to give, and he threw it right at the center of the Union line, reasoning that if they were strong on the left and strong on the right, they had to be weak in the middle. So 12,000 Confederate soldiers marched straight into the teeth of the Union center, cannons firing at them, Union soldiers firing at them. Half of them are casualties. The charge gets to the Union lines and, of course, never succeeds. And this really was the decisive moment for the battle. So my friend Jason and I walked Pickett's Charge, which you can still do. And it's a very humbling experience to walk towards the Union lines where you can see the cannon pointing at you. They have cannon across the battlefield today. You're walking right into the maw of those cannons. And so we were being very, very respectful, walking on the tracks that are there and just quietly asking one or two questions in case there were any entities that wanted to communicate with us. And what we recorded, we realized when we reviewed the data back later, we played the audio file back and we had recorded the sound of cannon fire at dawn. We hadn't heard it with our own ears, but we recorded the sound of cannon fire. And Pickett's Charge was preceded by the biggest massed artillery bombardment that the North American continent has ever seen. There was a massive artillery duel before that engagement, and I suspect that's what we recorded.
That's powerful. I've heard other people, Patrick Burns, a good friend of our show, they audibly heard loud booms that brought them out of their RV, and others that heard this at the same time. And that is something, I mean, not only just, you know, to pick up the recordings, but to hear this kind of disembodied cannon fodder is, hey, that's chilling, right? I mean, you're actually, in a sense, time traveling at that moment. You're a part of that environment and what was going on at that moment.
I did feel genuinely chilled and not in a way that was frightened or anything like that, but I also felt very privileged to have this small window into what did go on during those days. And I've talked to numerous people that have heard cannon fire in the area also. So it seems as though this this phenomena is on a continuous loop and that sometimes it can be picked up. And we tried to debunk it, of course. There are no reenactors letting off cannon at 6:30 in the morning in November. So, and we didn't hear it with our own ears. So the Klings had heard the same sort of thing. Numerous visitors to Gettysburg hear this kind of thing. And sometimes it is reenactors. Often it's just written off. But yeah, for sure, it was a very powerful feeling. And if your listeners would like to hear it, I have it posted up at my blog at richardestep.net. And they can judge for themselves.
Well, I don't know if if my producer, Nathan, can pull that up, and maybe we can play that during one of the next segments. I know we're up against a break here in a few minutes, but maybe we could play that when we come back in, if Nathan can snag that. That's awesome. I mean, it's sad, but it's awesome, right, that time continues to replay. Do you think that's what's going on? Is it replaying itself, or are we literally hearing through the veil of time?
My suspicion, Dave, because I've written about other haunted battlefields like the Battle of Edge Hill in England, which was part of our Civil War, far smaller than what America had. And the battle itself seemed to replay itself out as an anniversary haunting on the anniversary of the battle. And what's interesting is that when the first accounts, 20 years or so after the battle, the first ghost stories came out from Edge Hill, the full battle itself was being played out visually, including people that had not died. The king himself sent observers, including at least one general that fought in the battle. He witnessed this phenomenon and saw himself, which argues for either a recording or for, as you said, some kind of time slip. I'm not entirely sure which. And things dwindled over the years until finally just the sounds are reported today, you know, the sound of horses and screaming and swords clashing and those kind of things. With Gettysburg, which is a lot more recent, relatively speaking, and also, again, on a much bigger scale with many, many more deaths, I still think either possibility could be the case. But
we need to take a break here. Hold on, Richard. We'll be back. We've got more of the Ghosts of Gettysburg when we return to Coast AM. The Fairfield Haunting on Gettysburg's Ghost Trail. Richard Estep, our guest this evening, and we're talking about the new book, about the experiences in Gettysburg and the massive hauntings. We tried to pull up the audio. We were able to acquire it, but because of our translators, it ends up cleaning and scrubbing it, so it's almost a whisper to us, Richard. So I don't think we'd do it any justice, but what website can they go hear the cannon fodder on your recording?
If they go see me at richardestep.net and check my blog, they can hear that, and they can also hear about a nocturnal visitor we had while investigating the Fairfield Inn.
Oh, you can't dangle that carrot. I got to hear it now. A nocturnal visitor. Tell me about it.
Yeah, well, one of the things I'd wanted to do, I don't believe in a case like this, I don't believe in provocation. I think it would be very, very disrespectful, but I do believe in seeing what you can stimulate in a location. So I called Brad and Barry Kling and asked them if they would be put on speakerphone and perhaps try and stir things up for us a little bit at the inn. And so we put them on speakerphone. We lost connection with them at one point. And when we got back on the phone with the brothers, Brad said, heard a man's voice talking on the phone. It wasn't any of y'all. So that was quite interesting, but maybe just a technical glitch. We're not sure. They began to talk to the spirits of the inn, and they captured a very good Class A EVP that said the name Private John Riley. Your listeners that have seen that episode of Ghost Lab probably recall this, and also had captured a shadow figure in the mirror of the room that we were sitting in, the 1757 room, because it dated back to 1757. So they were kind enough to ask any of the spirits of the inn to come and interact with us that evening if they were willing. And we helped things along by playing some Civil War era music. Had a fairly quiet night other than recording what we thought was a baby crying. And went to bed at about 4 a.m. Now, some of our investigators were staying in Gettysburg itself. My fellow investigator, Catlin, and I were the only two staying at the entire inn. We had the whole building to ourselves. And she had a bedroom at the front of the inn. I had a bedroom at the back. About 4:30, I switch out the lights. I've been reading, just drifting off to sleep. And I hear a very loud door slamming from outside. And being the idiot that I quite often am, rather than get up there with my flashlight and go see, I thought, wow, the cook's in early. The chef, Chef Jonathan, is in early this morning. It's 5 o'clock. I cracked one eye open. It was actually 5 to 5 in the morning, I believe. And I thought, wow, they start early here, don't they? And I rolled back over and went to sleep because I was just exhausted. Go down to breakfast the next morning, and Catlin said, the strangest thing happened to me last night. At about 5 minutes to 5, I woke up and I was freezing cold, like Arctic freezing cold. I'd been toasty and warm when I went to bed. I'm suddenly freezing cold. So I pull up all the covers around my chin, go back to bed, and wake up this morning and feel fine. I said, really? 5 to 5, was it? Let me play back my audio. And sure enough, that's exactly when we recorded the sound of this very heavy door slamming downstairs. So we'd had some kind of visitor. It wasn't the front door. The whole place was locked. We were locked in. The only people with codes were the owners and the staff, and none of them had come in. And nobody was caught on any of our camera feeds, Dave. So whatever caused that door to slam, and we'd made a point of closing the doors before we went to bed, if for no other reason than, you know, fire regulations, keeping things nice and safe. Whoever caused that door to slam, we don't know to this day, but certainly wasn't a flesh and blood person, and none of the doors were propped open.
Now, the historic Fairfield Inn in Gettysburg there, that's the hotel and convention center, correct?
It's not a convention center, so no, it's actually an old coaching inn in the town of Fairfield, which is 8 miles outside Gettysburg.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, so it's not like a Fairfield Inn, as you would hear of the chain of hotels. This place dates back actually to the 1700s. And what you've got is this big ramshackle old building that was used by such people as Thaddeus Stevens. Now, during the Battle of Gettysburg, most people don't realize this, but while the main battle was going on, there were a whole bunch of ancillary battles going on around the place. And in Fairfield, on the third day of the battle, an American, excuse me, I beg your pardon, both sides were American, a U.S. cavalry regiment, the 6th, kind of was sent on a side mission. What happened was, and this sounds really suspicious now, this gentleman goes up to the headquarters of the Union troops and said, hey, there's this big fat Confederate cavalry chain not too far out of the town of Fairfield. You guys could capture that if you send a few horsemen out there. It was a logistics train, actually. So, you know, all the stuff an army runs on, the food and the ammunition and the medical supplies. So this would be a fairly good, easy victory, or so the Union thought. So they send the 6th Cavalry to go and capture this wagon train, not realizing that a whole bunch of the Confederate cavalry, brigades of the stuff, happens to be coming the opposite way. And historians are debating to this day whether this was a trap. The mysterious stranger that wanders in with this tip-off and then disappears was this one big setup for the Union forces. So the 6th basically get cut to pieces in what's called the Battle of Fairfield, which takes place just up the road from the Fairfield Inn. So they have 50% casualties in this unit, the 6th Cavalry. There are also Confederate casualties too. And all of the houses in Fairfield and around that place now have plaques saying that they were used essentially as field hospitals. They were pressed into service to treat the survivors of this cavalry battle. And then on the fourth day of the battle is the retreat. So General Lee retreats through Fairfield on his way away from Gettysburg, and he and General Jeb Stuart, who commands the Confederate cavalry, they stop for a meal at the Fairfield Inn, which is being used also as a field hospital. So this very old historic building has this very specific mark upon it already from being used as a hospital and from the visit by two of those great generals.
Again, just great history to these locations, and to know that there's all of this activity going on. Are there, you know, we hear about this kind of dark, and I don't mean this in the demonic sense, but this dark kind of weighted energy that's there, this activity that continues on there that seems steep in just the damage of the psyche of all the people that felt the pain going in there, on both sides of this war. But are there any accounts of a demonic energy, a more evil or elemental type of creature that's tied to these fields?
Not that I'm aware of, Dave. What we're primarily dealing with seems to be the spirits of those who fought in the battle. Delving into the Fairfield Inn's history, though, one of the entities that's believed to haunt the place is a nurse that goes back to that era. So somebody who cared for the wounded, which I can only imagine as a paramedic myself, I can only imagine what it must have been like to cope with this just massive influx of horrendous injuries. I mean, these were the days when the doctors were working as fast as they could to saw off limbs, and they would have these piles of amputated arms, legs, hands, feet that they would just stack up outside the buildings, you know? So I think that the caregivers also probably contributed to the emotional component of this particular haunting. And there are stories of some of the Confederates being buried in the ground around the inn. I do believe they're unsubstantiated stories, but they appear in multiple sources of these poor boys being buried in the ground around the inn. And then as the war moved away from Gettysburg, some of them were not recovered and are believed to still be there.
That's heartbreaking.
It is.
Is there an overwhelming sense in some points of this where people just lose it emotionally, whether it's sense of anger or just, you know, involuntary weeping?
In terms of visitors to the inn, do you mean?
Yes.
You get some interesting emotional reactions from people that come there. And one of the things I made a point of doing was combing through the visitor logs. The owners leave guest books out for visitors to record their experiences. And quite a few of them do mention ghosts and seemingly inexplicable phenomena. An emotional turmoil, unexplained moods, mood swings, a sense of fear, a sense of dread, those sorts of things are documented there. But you do have to ask yourself how much of that psychological priming, you know, knowing that you're in a location which has had those kind of events take place, how much of that is the mind playing tricks? It's something that we all have to guard ourselves against when we investigate these sorts of locations.
Right. And in investigating this, do you have to handle the investigation differently than you would a normal haunted house or location? Is there a different protocol you use when dealing with battlefields and places of this ilk?
Well, definitely when you're outdoors, it makes things a lot more challenging. But when we were investigating the inn itself, it was actually very easy in terms of controlling the environment because we had the whole place to ourselves. So we had five investigators and we locked ourselves in, made sure that everything was secure, and we were able to pretty much roam as we wanted. And we would chase down phenomena as it occurred. The night that I mentioned where we had the Kling brothers phone in, we heard running footsteps on the staircase. So we would go and investigate a specific part of the inn. On another evening, we went downstairs to the old part of the house because there are multiple parts. The oldest part does date back to the early 1700s, and it's a homestead. Now, we were down there, and we started to hear knocking and rapping, which couldn't be explained by the sounds of the building settling or shifting. And one of the reasons I like to immerse myself in a location and actually move in there for a week or so, if possible, is it takes that long to get used to the structure. You said earlier, Dave, that your son was a firefighter, correct?
Right.
Now, as a former firefighter myself, one thing your son will tell you is that we study construction, and I'm sure you know this. We study the way that a building behaves in terms of airflow and how it will start to expand and contract, especially when you add fire and water loads and those kind of things. So it takes a good day in that environment to get used to the normal sounds of the pipes and air moving through ducts and various drafts and those kind of things. You learn the building and study it as you would study any other subject in detail. It really is our battleground as paranormal investigators.
Right, and getting that sense for these locations. That's why I tell people, if you're going to do this, it's not like it's, you know, shown on TV. You really have to kind of absorb the environment of these locations and put yourself there for numerous days, daylight and nighttime, so that you get a sense and a feel, and you start to actually tell when energies shift in a location like that too.
Yeah, I think you'd learn to read it. And it's true with our own homes, isn't it? We can read the energy in our own homes. We know how they're going to behave at a given time of year for the most part, and a given time of the day or the night. We know that when that floorboard creaks, it's fairly normal because it sounds just like that and it happens at that certain time or certain temperature. But you can't do that overnight. You need to put in some time to get familiar.
All right. Now, the idea, too, of bringing in all this type of equipment, is there equipment that you typically stay away from, or are you willing to employ anything to give it a shot to see if there's some way to record the spiritual energy in a location?
You know, I've become less of a tech head as I've been doing this for longer and longer. When I started out, I wanted as much sensory and recording apparatus as I could lay my hands on. And when I finally, I investigated Waverly Hills a few years ago, and of course, we had that location for 8 hours. And by the time we'd finished running our camera cables, 25 to 30% of our time was gone.
Right.
And you also have to review hours and hours and hours of footage. So I realized that probably the old Mark I eyeball is the best piece of sensory equipment we have. I like to record audio continuously, and I like to record video, but I won't necessarily go through it all if there's no suspected reason to do that. You know, in terms of the latest gadgets, you hear of things like the Poltercom and stuff along those lines. I think it's very much a double-edged sword. I like the Ovilus, even the one that speaks with your voice, Dave, which we've taken to a few locations. There's a man that likes his word. We had a terrific Ovilus hit at this location, let me tell you. It turns out there's a plaque on the wall downstairs that tells you that a battery of Confederate artillery was stationed there on the third day of the Battle of Gettysburg. And we got an Ovilus hit that said Southern Cannon. Now, I'm not a huge believer in coincidence, and that one really did impress me. Southern canon.
And when you get something like that, Richard, and you're trying to be objective, you know, does it still give you a thrill on this, or do you start needing to break it down and you know, overanalyze all of it?
Well, we all have a different threshold for evidence, don't we? We all have a different bar. It's set at a different place. I used to not be a fan of that particular device until I heard it make some hits that were just spectacularly close. So it's important to remember, though, that 90% of what comes through a device like that can be gibberish. And we tend to focus on the 5 or 10% that's meaningful. And again, that's a psychological phenomenon. It's the way we are. But I think that you can get some valuable evidence with equipment like that. It's just not dependable or reliable. So on the one hand, you have the whiz-bang technical aspects, the gadgets. And on the other, I also like some of the more traditional methods, the ones that the original paranormal investigators, Conan Doyle and Crookes and Lodge, that those gentlemen employed. You know, something as simple as using marbles or small tennis balls or something like that to check for subsidence and check for slopes in the floor that you may not be there. Those kind of things.
All right, we're up against a break here. And then when we come back, we'll be opening up phone lines. If you've had experiences in Gettysburg, if you have questions for our guest, we'll be taking your calls in a little bit. I want to hear some more of the experiences that you were able to record and some of the other experiences that were shared with you about this area and the hauntings that take place in and around the Fairfield Inn in Gettysburg. We've got about 30 seconds left here, but did you spread out? Did you get a chance to investigate any other local areas to that, you know, similar to that in the local area?
Our investigation was on the battlefield itself. We can talk about that later. But we did get to visit some well-known haunted locations, such as the Jenny Wade House.
Great. Well, why don't you tell us about that when we come back? We'll hear about your experiences, some of the other things that you guys were able to record. And I'll also mention a very weird experience I had when we were out in Gettysburg, too, one on the battlefield and one in the house at one of the hotels that they keep on site. We'll discuss all of that and more when we return. You're listening to Coast to Coast AM.